This is the Podmatic Podcast for April 20th, 2016. 'Cause I'm the tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. This is the Popmatic Podcast, where you can snarf your coffee and also where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are...
Jeremy.
Bill.
IRS agent number 12346.
Amanda. Clem Marie.
This is a full house.
It is a
yes.
Full
indeed.
House.
Indeed.
Oh, Lord, no.
Is it a fuller house, Jeremy?
It is 2 days after tax day, so I know many of you are pulling your hair out. But Caesar says, show me the money.
Whoa.
So in this episode.
Is that a direct quote?
I think so.
Caesar gave us three more days.
You know, we need to say
Matthew
it
24:16.
Give to Caesar what is Caesar, and give to God what is God's.
Caesar says seven.
I wish I could. I knew how to say show me the money in Latin.
That would be awesome. Yeah,
show me the money!
Say it in the comments.
Habeas.
Moneyus.
Daenerys.
So on this episode, things that are taxing. Now, this is actually a two-parter, which is new for us. It's a double rainbow of a priori joy. Because we are a pop culture podcast, we're going to do a two-part episode on death and taxes. This week, taxes.
We should end on a cliffhanger.
This week, taxes.
Next week, we all die.
Next week,
Bill, what are you
doing?
Bill, what are you doing with that bucket? No!
This week, taxes. Next week, death.
Death.
Jeremy?
Yes, Brian.
You ever been taxed?
I have been taxed, now that you mention it. When I was a boy, my mom went to the library and she checked out the biggest book that I had ever seen in my life. It was a cinder block sized hardcover.
It was Costello.
It was.
4 volumes of Ninja Turtles.
Everybody, shut up! I'd seen this author's name before. I'd seen his face and heard his voice on television. But here his name loomed large over the title of the book. His name was Stephen King, and the book was It.
So
on the cover were four green claws reaching out of a sewer grate, ready to snatch up a paper boat as it floated past. A couple years later, this image would have evoked thoughts of Ninja Turtles, but at the time, I thought little of it because horror didn't come from books, it came from movies. Horror had proper names like Freddy and Jason, and I didn't see anything scary about vague pronouns, probably because I was too young to know what a pronoun was. My real introduction to It...
Not a fan of them.
Yeah.
Us. Yeah. That's
they.
Yeah. Us.
Us.
Us Weekly had a subscription. Whoa.
Well, that's Us Weekly's theme for it is it? Quite scary.
Oh, okay.
How much they shame celebrities.
They're just like us, though. They're just like us. Beeps. My real introduction to It was the TV movie, which aired on November 18th, 1990. That's my dad's birthday. I was in, this is a birthday episode. I was in fifth grade at the time, and I was in the middle of reading Misery, which is the first Stephen King book I read. I read that because I wanted to see the movie, which was released 12 days after it aired on television. My dad set the VCR kids, the VCR, to record it for me, and I watched it as soon as I possibly could, but I have no memory of seeing it because my brain will not allow those memories to be processed. I only remember the aftermath, and I was terrified. I had already suffered from clown-based trauma before before seeing Tim Curry as Pennywise the Clown because I had this clown painting hanging on the wall of my bedroom because my mom didn't like a bare wall, and I had no aesthetic autonomy at the time. So I would stare at this picture in the moonlight as I was trying to go to sleep at night, and like its face would contort and twist and get all evil, and I was tripping on pixie sticks. So watching the movie led to sleepless nights and a lifelong fear of sewer grates, but it only kept me from the book for a few years. By the time I was a senior in high school, I thought the fear was gone, so I was like, I'm going to read this book. I don't care if I was scared by that movie when I was a dumb kid. So I'd read even more Stephen King books by then and had not really been scared, terribly buy any of them. So I picked up a copy of It at a flea market. And the only thing I was afraid of was how long the thing was. It's over 1,000 pages. So I devoured the first 150 pages like Pennywise eats children. And then the familiar feeling came back of something in the room with me every time I turned off the light. Or of something about to emerge around every corner. And then, of course, if I was anywhere outside near a sewer grate, I was bound to see a clown down there. So everybody in the world in this room has started a book that they couldn't finish, especially a long novel. But it was a book that I wanted to finish but couldn't, and I still haven't. I couldn't face another page. It was too taxing, you might say. At the time, I removed my bookmark, put the paperback in a cabinet under my bookshelf. Jeez. With the cover facing the wall. I was 17, and I surrounded it with other books, like James Bond books and other Stephen King books, and forgot about it. I got rid of it a few years later and just said, no, I'm not going to read it. But in the last couple of years, I got another copy, and I'm reading the book now, and I'm halfway finished. But I thought it would be different this time, but it is the same, and so am I scared. And sometimes even terrified. Like, if you got to go to the bathroom in the middle of the night, better not be some terrifying clown in your house.
That's just true in general.
I know. That's true. That's true.
I don't want Stephen King to tell me that.
So this time...
Unless you're married to a clown.
Well.
Especially if you're married to a clown.
Well.
I think that's my role in our household.
You eat the children.
Clowning around.
So this time I'm not just scared of what's on the page. I'm afraid I won't be able to stop. Amanda...
I can't go. So I'm scared.
So you pulled a Brian and didn't actually read it.
I'm halfway finished.
Although I don't know. I think I may change it from pulling a Brian to pulling an Amanda because you didn't actually watch the movie that you recommended.
Hey, I've since watched it. So my whole stitch was longer than I thought.
You didn't just recommend it. You put it on the year.
Yeah, it was best of the year. You couldn't think of
it. It takes guts to do that.
I would say it takes chutzpah.
There you go.
I admired your audacity.
Yeah. There you go.
Thank you.
I work at it. Okay. So this year, Easter was on March 27th, and the 40 days before that consists of a period known as Lent. And it's a common practice in the Catholic Church to give up something like meat as a penitent discipline. Now, I'm not Catholic, but my family also grew up that we would give up something for Lent. But as a switch, the last couple of years, I have decided to read more in-depth, or i.e. hard, church books as my Lenten devotional. These are books that are very widely read and highly recommended for the most part, but just not something that I would ever sit down and read for fun, because I need the extra discipline from the church's calendar to help me actually finish these. And my favorite book from this past Lenten season was The Pilgrim's Progress. And I would say this is one most people probably have heard of, but maybe like me, not actually read. It was written by John Bunyan in 1678, and it's a Christian allegory that contains the full title, The Pilgrim's Progress, From This World to That Which Is to Come, Delivered Under the Similitude of a Dream. So that's kind of a mouthful, but it's commonly regarded as one of the most significant works of religious English literature, and it has never been out of print in its 300 plus years of existence. So that's pretty impressive. The story follows main character Christian as he forsakes his family in the city of destruction and sets forth on a long journey to reach the celestial city in order to avoid the coming end of the world destruction. So Bunyan's character names are very, what we will call, Dickensian.
Or on the nose.
Yes.
So even, allegory, you say.
Yes, yes.
He runs into allegory.
We would say it's Dickensian, even though Bunyan beat him to it by about 200 years, with character names like Pliable, Mr. Worldly Wiseman, and Faithful. The Penguin edition that I read had two parts, the original Pilgrim's Progress and then the sequel that he published in 1684, featuring Christian's wife, Christiana.
Oh, man.
The feminine
30 form. Seconds, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, her journey will be different.
So considering this book was written in 1678, I thought it would be harder to read. And I'm sure that it's been translated a few times. And the edition that I read had a lot of margin notes that were kind of distracting for a first-time reader. Mm. But overall, I really liked it. The hard part comes in when you consider how dense the book is. Even though it was written by what amounted to a simple country pastor in the Church of England, The Pilgrim's Progress has a lot of layers. And each segment where Christian learns a lesson can take a while to work through. So when I was reading it, it took me about 2 hours to get through roughly 50 pages, which is really slow for me. The Pilgrim's Progress is definitely a book I could read and reread for the next several Lents, and I have a feeling I would find something new each time. But it really was one of my favorites that I read for this season. Mac?
See, I want to say we have a book, something like The Pilgrim's Journey or something. Wasn't there like a cartoon miniseries in the 80s that they did an adaptation?
There have been a lot of adaptations of that particular. It's kind of the classic story you go back to.
Yeah, I checked out the book version and I never read it.
Okay.
Was it too taxing for you?
Yeah. Very good.
Thank you.
You know, see, I thought today's episode would be on pins or thumbtacks, but...
Jeez.
It's weird how memory works. There are flashes of things I remember watching with my parents that I would become obsessed with tracking down years later. Why, I'm still not sure. For example, one afternoon I remember watching a movie with my dad where I was convinced that Charles Bronson was pouring goo on someone's face and then killing them with ravenous locusts. But after some Google searching 15 years later, it turns out that it was Vincent Price pouring goo on somebody's face and then killing them with ravenous locusts. And the amazing, the abominable Dr. Fibes.
Can you imagine if... If
it was Charles Price Bronson.
Was like, hey.
My dad loves Charles Bronson movies.
Death Wish featuring.
Death Wish. There we go.
Vincent Price. That'd be amazing.
I've seen a lot of Death Wishes.
You're all going to die.
They did co-star in a movie together, House of Wax.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. Very nice. Thank you, Bill Interlude. Today, I was thinking about the long and very complicated miniseries I, Claudius, which I remember watching part of with my parents when I was very young. I think it turned out that they actually never watched the rest of it, and both of them were like, wait, what? You tracked down this show we watched once?
Who cares? They opted for Caligula instead.
We're out, you know. I mean, I remember I did that with a book that my dad was like, this book is amazing, Mark. It's totally cool. And then 20 years later, I read it. I'm like, Dad, you're right. This book is really cool. And he's like, what book? What? What are you talking about? Anyway, it's called Tigana by Guy Cabriel K, gang. And it really, but this miniseries really stuck with me. All these British people yelling in togas at each other. It was great. Also, note, I am not recommending the book I, Claudius by Robert Graves. I only attempted to read Robert Graves' The Greek Myths one once, which can serve as a sleep aid. 100 pages in, and the world had been created 5 or 6 times. There's only so many times I could read about the world being created. Anyway.
Blast from the past.
Oh.
I am throwing down my, I don't mean to bring it down.
That's right.
Robert Graves' historical novels, maybe not his retelling of myths, but his historical novels, all the Claudius novels, Count Belisarius, are amazing. I totally recommend them. Of course, he also wrote one of the seminal memoirs about World War I. Goodbye to all that. Okay, I'm done.
I could listen to creation myths all day long.
Yes.
Also.
Oh. Where's the pun? I'm confused. Yeah. I could create
it'll
many
come
creation
later as a big bang.
And he was a next door neighbor to T.E. Lawrence.
Oh.
Yep. This is going to be the longest episode. I, Claudius, is a fictional biography of the Emperor Claudius, beginning from about 10 years before he was born to the day that he died. Claudius was the grandson of Augustus, founder of the Julio-Claudian dynasty, the very first imperial family in Roman history.
This is interesting.
I have to hear about Elvis Costello.
Leave him alone. This is interesting.
He said the books were boring. Yeah, I was the miniseries is kind of regarded as a masterpiece.
Yeah, that's right.
I love British people yelling at each other. Please continue.
Yeah, many times. Isaac March. He realized early on that his family are a bunch of homicidal maniacs, constantly pointing at each other and jockeying for positions of power. So he used his horrible stutter and permanent limp to his advantage. He would pretend to be a simple dummy, and they would not see him as a threat and leave him alone. As a kid, I picked up on this too. Why, even today, I'd rather not talk about how really excited I get about the metaphysics of the Divine Comedy, or rather reality as a social construct or a personal delusion. So I learned early on to focus on aspects of my personality that I think others will like. Hey, has anybody seen Batman v Superman? Martha, am I right?
That's a bad example because everyone hates
that. Yeah, but everybody's seen it and had not read.
They said that it was like one of the highest grossing superhero movies.
That's right.
Of recent memory.
Yeah. Divine Comedy is one of my favorite books. I refuse to mention on the podcast. I picked.
What's wrong with that? let your light shine.
That's not happening.
That's right.
I really like Robert Graves, and I'm not afraid to say it.
There you go.
I like some people, and I like to talk about them.
For some reason, you're perpetually harassed.
It's as if things that I like make me some kind of outcast.
Whatever, Kim Graves. What's her name?
Wow. What
is that one?
Get it right.
Don't even go there, man.
Robert Graves. I picked this.
the miniseries for today's recommendation because it'd be incredibly hard to follow. While the early, while the only emperors of the Julio-Claudian dynasty were Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero, each of them also have huge families, groups of friends, rivals, heirs to their respective subfamilies. And at one point, I had to get out a piece of paper and jot down an ersatz family tree because I could not follow. This was the early 90s. You didn't have the internet to look this stuff up. Some characters have entire arcs, while others are introduced and killed in a single episode. And you're supposed to remember their names and who they were like three episodes later.
Who's Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Do they all have like the same name too? Like, because the TV show Rome, when that was like, they were like all like one letter off.
Well, if you want to hear some classical misogyny, the men in a family got a cool name, while the women just got a like female version of the family name. Like, so it's Claudia. Yeah. A lot of Claudias.
Christiana.
Yeah, exactly.
It's as if women are diminished in their roles throughout history.
Who knew?
Stupid boys.
No. Long live Cleopatra.
Smashed a patriarchy.
Denial.
The acting is really superb. Brian Blessed as Augustus can never whisper. He can only act. I am acting. Gordon. He is the best. I love him. You can put him as a GPS. I suggest it, gang. Cyan Phillips is outstanding as Livia, Augustus's wife and sinister manipulator behind the throne. In history, Augustus was credited with founding the Roman Empire, but in this version, Livia is obviously the brains of the operation. John Hurt as the Joker. I mean, Caligula, super creepy. And Derek Jacobi as Claudius is a great hero, an admitted coward who eventually gets corrupted by power, but is always sympathetic. We have the complete series as one set or individual discs. It's 12 hours. Yeah, it's 12 hours. Yeah, 12 episodes, an hour apiece. But I recommend watching one a day. And there's also a cool documentary on the DVDs about the aborted making of a Charles Laughton adaptation back in the 30s.
Ooh, if you're interested in Charles Laughton.
What have you got, Clemarie?
Yes. Okay, so sometimes you pick up a book and you're not ready to read that book because you're going to put it down. But then a couple of years later you find, okay, and then you pick it up now. And you're like, yes, I am ready to read this book. So I was finally able to read, 4 years after first purchasing it, 100 Years of Solitude. However,
since you had 96 years left, so you were good.
Yes.
Oh!
Pun! So, but because I speak Spanish, I read in Spanish, my first language is Spanish, I decided to... I have the opportunity to read a book in the original language. So I read Cien Años de Soledad by Gabriel García Márquez, 100 Years of Solitude. When I first picked it up, I could not even get past the first chapter. A couple of years later, in graduate school, I think while I needed some sort of respite from all the theology and philosophy I was reading, I would, before bed, I would lay down and read a bit of the book at night. Now, sometimes I would fall asleep and be reading. Like, I don't remember any of this happening, so I would have to go back and read. Oh, okay. So, 100 Years of Solitude, for those of you who don't know, is Gabriel García's Márquez, the writer born in Colombia. He won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1982. He just recently died in 2014, but 100 Years of Solitude still remains probably his masterwork. It is the story of the Buendía family, a family in Macondo, in the fictional town of Macondo, which is supposed to be, it's pretty much a proxy for Colombia and Latin America as a whole. It's one of the prime examples, the novel's one of the prime examples of magical realism, where the supernatural is the everyday, the normal. In 100 Years of Solitude, you know, a woman, you know, a beautiful woman ascends to the sky, you know, instead of dying. And this just happens on a regular afternoon. Because that is in part why... That's what, in a sense, what Latin America is, where the strange is the everyday. Gabriel García Márquez covers the story of the founding of Macondo to its move from a colonial state to an independent state to being under the American Fruit Company, American control, and all of that. And so the story itself is a story of this family and all their loves, their tribulations, their incestual affairs, their political machinations, and all of that. It took me about 3 to 4 months to finish this book because I would read a bit a night and I would read in Spanish. And I really did enjoy it. It is a masterwork. I reread the first chapter and it is amazing. Like, just sort of, okay, I remember why I finally got this. Because for me to read in Spanish, there is a different rhythm. The English translation is done by Gregory Rabassa, I believe. And it is, I read the first part of it. It is beautiful. It's a beautifully done translation. It is a lot less taxing because I can actually understand. And, you know, it acts, no matter what, Spanish is, always has an ornateness to it. English does not. English, the power of English that is so succinct. Spanish is not. So the first part in English, like, okay, I was moving along. In the Spanish version, it takes me a little while to get in the rhythm. But of course, 100 Years of Solitude is known for the very famous line, the very first opening line, and I'm going to read it, if you will indulge me. Many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendía was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. Well, that's when the novel begins, as Macondo being a small town and a band of gypsies coming in who bring all the inventions of the world, and it moves through the entire family story and through Colombia's history and Latin America's history as a whole. This was a really good book. It is a masterpiece of literature. It may take you several months to finish it like I did. And if you have the opportunity to read a book in its original language, I think I'm very happy to be able to do that. So I really enjoyed it, talking about books that I started and that I put down because I could not do it. I tried to read José Saramago's Blindness, which was originally written in Portuguese, another Nobel winner for literature. It was originally written in Portuguese, so I thought I'll read it in Spanish because Spanish and Portuguese, you know, closer enough. I only got about halfway through that book. Oh, dear gosh. It was...
Is that the one about death?
No, blindness, yeah, the whole... Like
an epidemic strikes the globe and most, yes, people become blind.
Blind. Right. And the people who are blind get put into an asylum, at least at the city where it starts. And it was a little...
It's made to a movie with Julianne
Moore. Yes, it was. And that's, I saw that. I'm like, okay, that was written from a book. I'll go read it. I could not finish that book. That book was just, it was killing my soul. It was killing my soul. It sits on my bookshelf. I got about halfway through. I'm like, this is just going to be, and this is going to end badly for everyone. I'm going to put this away. So that is my taxing book, which I ultimately enjoyed 4 years and 4 months later. 100 Years of Solitude, Cien Años de Soledad by Gabriel García Márquez.
You know, that's a fantastic book. And 1 year, me and my buddies, we came back to college. And as soon as we saw each other, I was like, there's this book you have to read. You have to read it. And he's like, what is the book? I was like, 100 Years of Solitude. He's like, I was going to tell you to read that book. I was like, no way.
Oh.
So I think if, like, I had to pick, like, one novel that every human being should read, like, it would probably be that book. So
I would say he's really dense, though. Like, just in evening, I haven't read it in Spanish. I don't speak Spanish. But, like, I've read García Márquez, and, like, I felt like there was a lot going on.
There's a lot going on.
It does take you a minute to kind of process and work through it. And,
yeah, I think I found the English translation a little more smooth because I had already read the book in Spanish. Okay, I know what I'm getting into, mm-hmm. but, okay, it's a very readable and well-done translation from the part that I read. Because the Spanish, there are parts where I'm like, what is it? Because Spanish is always this ornateness to it. Even in modern contemporary novels, there's always this ornateness to Spanish. So I really enjoyed that book, and I believe Bill is next.
The book that I found was taxing, but I finally made it through it. And when I did finally make it through it, I found it very rewarding, was World War Z, An Oral History of the Zombie War by Max Brooks. Now, World War Z is not a traditional horror novel. It's a collection of personal accounts following the zombie apocalypse. The author, Max Brooks, son of the late great actress Anne Bancroft and director Mel Brooks, is a huge fan of historical novels of Stud Terkel's. Well, he did the same thing, but instead of war or depression, he dealt with the zombie war. The first time I started World War Z, I must confess I found the style off-putting. I guess I was expecting more of a thrill ride. Then I had a chance to hear Max Brooks speak at a signing of his book, and he was so entertaining, I thought, well, I've got to give this a chance. I did give the book a chance, and I'm glad I did because the novel is both intelligent and thrilling. It's very haunting, too. So my advice, if you get started to read the book, and I've read other people have the same problem, I say just stick with it. You don't like the style, just stick with it because it's extremely rewarding and not taxing at all. It really becomes a page-turner. The name of the book is World War Z, An Oral History of the Zombie War by Max Brooks. And just one more thing. We have the play array and the CD audio of World War Z. I've heard this. I have not listened to it myself, but I heard that the audio recording is one of the best audio recordings of a book ever.
Yeah.
It won the Audi for Best Audio Recording of 2007. And it's got this full cast recording with people like Alan Alda, Mark Hamill, John Turturro. So they're doing the recording. So I highly recommend World War Z by Max Brooks. Brian.
I second this recommendation. It's an amazing book. It's a series of vignettes like interviews. And what's neat is that like they never go back to any of the interviewees. So like if you're curious about what happened to that person, you'll never know, which is like almost kind of creepy. But you know, they all kind of survived at the end. But it's really neat that like each segment felt or each interview felt different. So if there's like a character you don't like, you could just skip two pages and get to somebody else. And also, he also wrote the Zombie Survival Guide.
That's true.
It's an amusing book if you want to like know that a machete is way better than a gun will ever be.
I learned that watching The Walking Dead, that you should have a katana, because that's the weapon that I want.
Okay. Right. I get my dad's machete from his from the garage. My dad always says that every Puerto Rican man has to have a machete. It's a very gendered opinion, but my brother does have a machete of his own.
I'll go get Danny Trejo.
I don't have a machete, but I'll work on it. I mean, not a bad idea.
It's Christmas.
Not a bad idea.
Yeah. So
if you need to hack like palm trees in your yard, that's where you. That's what you need.
I get a machete, but only to deal with my annoying neighbors.
All right. Well, Mike is killing his neighbors. I'm usually at book club here at the library, and
it's not a once monthly thing. It's a special event.
I kind of want to give a shout out to one of my longtime book club members, Bill. Not our podcast, Bill, but just Bill from the Second Wednesday Book Club. Bill is actually a lawyer for the IRS, and he usually keeps that private, but I think he's okay with me saying so on the podcast. And Bill also is a very special member of the book club. He's been attending the Second Wednesday Book Club since we started in 1998.
Wow.
That is before I was the book club facilitator, but there are a handful of people that still come to the Second Wednesday Book Clubs from the time it started. And Bill actually has filled in for me as facilitator for a few times. He's a really dedicated book club member. Now, ironically, we rarely choose Bill's books. so sometimes I kind of feel bad. But at the same time, Bill also is an attorney, and he has a forceful personality, and he often dominates the conversation. So that I don't feel so bad, right? So, you know what I mean? He gets his rocks in. You know,
objection.
You know, his opinion gets known, you know, whether we read the books that he suggests or not. But one time, the book club facilitator didn't order books on time. So we had to scramble and get books. And Bill had suggested the book The Mayflower by Nathaniel Philbrick. And I was like, well, I don't know if we're going to like that, but the library has copies of it. So we're going to read that book. And we never read Bill's suggestions, even though he always comes and always has a lot to say. We never pick his book. So we read The Mayflower by Nathaniel Philbrick, and it was awesome because we read it right around Thanksgiving.
Oh.
And even though it's called The Mayflower, it's actually only like the first quarter is about the Mayflower, and then the rest is just about the history of colonial New England. So it was like the perfect thing to read on Thanksgiving. I would say that The Mayflower by Nathaniel Philbrick is kind of the typical book that Bill would suggest. So popular nonfiction author, you know, has something to do with you know, American history. But one time he suggested this book, Treat Us Like Dogs and We Will Become Wolves by Carolyn Shute. And I was like, what? That is the best title ever. That does not, that does not sound like something Bill would typically recommend.
Sounds kind of rough.
So I was like, what is that book? I have to check that out. So, of course, we didn't vote for it. We didn't read it. But just by the title, I was like, I have to go check this out. So I get it. And within 5 seconds, you kind of realize that this is an author that is operating, for lack of a better term, sort of outside of the academy. You know, like when you first get the book, there's this little glossary of icons that are in the book. So she actually lists small icons. There are all these little like visual icons, like little drawings that are in the book. And one is a UFO and it says the Grays. And one is a money sign and it says the voice of Mammon. And one is an ear, and it says the FCC. I was like, oh, okay, that's cool, right? I'm down with that. I'm kind of interested in that. But also, the book is 700 pages long, so that kind of makes me not interested. And in the introduction, she's like, hey, if you get confused, don't worry. There's a list of characters in the back, and the list of characters is like 50 pages long.
Whoa!
And I'm like, oh okay, I'll think about that. So then I was like, so I've never heard of this person, but like she's publishing these really big books. So I look her up. And Carolyn Shute, I discovered, is like basically this off-the-grid hillbilly gun rights activist from Maine. And I was like, wow. And I can say hillbilly because I'm a hillbilly. Someone else will say that. So, and I was like, that's interesting. And she's like, she writes novels. And her most famous novel that I don't think I'd ever heard of was called The Beans of Egypt, Maine, which maybe some of you have heard of this.
I've heard of that title, I think.
Oh, yes.
I'm immediately kind of fascinated about the story about Treatise Like Dogs is going to be, because I know the setup, because I've read far enough. Oh, I'm spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
Too taxing for me to finish too long, right? But I still want to read it.
You guys.
But the beginning is like this idea that there's this like off-the-grid compound where these kids are, and people are calling the local newspaper and suggesting that these kids are being like abused or maltreated somehow, and like sort of like Waco, David Koresh kind of cult things going on, right? But just from what I know about Shute, I know she's like a gun rights activist, and she's like, go live away from the government and away from corporations. So I'm just wondering how she's going to treat the topic of guns, which in the past, there's been some really interesting literary treatment about guns and gun culture in books that we've talked about on the show. So like the Mad Adam trilogy by Margaret Atwood, which is one of my favorite books in the last couple.
That's a good one.
In the last couple years, like the whole idea of like, there's one gun that just plays a really big role in the story and it's really interesting, or the way anti-government separatists were treated in the Reamde book by Neal Stephenson. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of interested how she's going to treat that. But then I also got to thinking, like, is she an outsider artist? Because we were talking about Daniel Johnston.
Yes!
Nailed it.
And you know, this idea of, like, what is an outsider artist? And I guess I kind of just come back to the idea that maybe that idea just doesn't really make any sense, right? Either you just have certain degrees of fame or not. Mm-hmm. And I think Caroline Shute, even if she doesn't want to be, even if she lives out in the woods in Maine, like, she's gotten a MacArthur Genius Grant.
She actually won a Guggenheim Fellowship, not a MacArthur Genius Grant.
She puts out big 700-page novels by a big major mainstream publisher. So there's that. So anyway, I have not finished, but I want to finish the 700-page Treatise Like Dogs, and We Will Become Wolves by Caroline Shute, suggested by Bill, one of my most dedicated book club members. What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well, maybe the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't. But either way, it's tickling our fancy.
Amanda?
So I've mentioned that my husband and I recently moved into a new house, which has necessitated lots of moving boxes and going up and down stairs and painting, especially lots of painting. And stairs. I have to admit that I'm a pretty seasoned painter, but I'm not always the neatest in the world. So blue painter's tape is an absolute must. And I usually use those big plastic drop cloths to protect the floor. But those bubble up and slide around and can sometimes cause more problems than they prevent, especially when you spill the paint on them and you're not careful and you walk through it. But I've never done that. But I have come across a new product that is totally awesome and helpful. So did you know that you could buy what amounts to cling wrap for carpet? It's sticky on one side, and you can just roll it over your carpet and smooth it down so it'll stick, and then you can paint away to your heart's content. Wow. You can also use it to protect your carpets from, like, dirty shoes and, you know, big mover boots and all that, and help keep it clean. Now, you can't stick it – warning, you can't stick it on hardwoods or tile, but it is fabulous on carpets, and it probably shaved 3 hours and 6 messes off of my painting time. So I got it at Lowe's in the flooring department. I had to ask about it, but the guy knew what I was talking about and took me right there. You can probably get it at any home improvement store. And if you need to paint or want to keep your carpets clean, check out Plastic Carpet Protector.
My favorite Tickle My Fancy
store. I know, right?
Where we endorse products. I did the cookie butter. He did the apple Newtons. You did something last week, too.
I don't remember what I talked about. The Burger Republic.
The Burger Republic.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I love it. I love it.
I love the Omni Hut,
yeah.
I want to... just basically have a wild party now. I just want to put it down and then just go cut loose.
You could, and then just peel it up and throw it away. Exactly.
They could do a reboot of Dexter too, and it'd be like a whole
Yeah, Dexter. Well, see, he never was over carpet, though. Like, I guess that's true, you can't put it on hardwood floor.
Okay.
Or American Psycho. Yeah.
But that would be a boon for, like, grandmothers who everywhere who want to cover everything in plastic.
Yeah, they cover their couch in plastic. Yeah. You just put it on your floor. And
I had a relative who had the plastic runners all over the carpet. Oh, man. Oh, Lord.
Good stuff.
Marie.
Yes. So today on Tickle My Fancy, I want to talk about the return of Outlander. Outlander on Starz. For those of you that are not familiar with the Outlander phenomenon, Outlander is a series of books, very long historical novels written by Diana Gabaldon. I'm not sure how to pronounce her name.
I believe it's Gabaldon.
Gabaldon. Thank you.
My coworker, Susan, you guys can have a nice long chat about okay. how amazing Outlander is and how everybody is great.
Okay, well, it has been adapted into a TV series on Starz, and the second season premiered this Saturday. This is why I pay $10 extra a month on my cable bill, just to have Starz, just so I can watch Outlander. If you're not familiar with Outlander, it's the story of a time-traveling World War II nurse who travels during her second honeymoon with her husband Frank in the Scottish Highlands. She travels through a set of stones and goes to 18th century Scotland, where she, you know, where she gets caught up in political machinations, marries a strapping Highlander named Jamie Fraser, and they have a love affair for the ages, and also a story for the ages as well. In the second season, Jamie and Claire, the protagonist, are now in France in the court, in the French court, where they are trying to stop the Jacobite Rebellion, which, if you're familiar with your history or familiar with all the Outlander novels, the Jacobite Rebellion to take back the Scottish throne by King Bonnie Prince Charles will end in the resounding defeat of the Highlanders at Culloden Moor, and then the subsequent dismantling of Highlander culture by...
There can be only none.
Exactly. According to the British, there can only be none. There can be no Highlanders. So...
I am one Highlander for me. Yes. Christopher Lambert.
So if you have access to Starz, the second season of Outlander is out. I am very, very excited. I cannot wait till this Saturday. If you have never watched Outlander, the library has this first season on DVD. It's in two volumes because it's a very long season. We have all the books in print. We have all the books in electronic version. We have all the books in audio. They are very long books.
How many are there? There's a bunch, right?
I believe there's like eight. Hey, yeah. The eighth one
she
just
still
came.
Isn't finished.
She still has not finished
it's
the story.
It's very kind of George R. R. Martin.
She's the lady George R. R. Martin. Yeah.
She loves this story. She loves these characters. I do sometimes wonder, they are fantastic stories, but I sometimes wonder, does she have an editor? Because these books, I mean, they are doorstops.
Yeah, they're all real big.
But yes, that's what's tickling my fancy. Then in the next couple of weeks, I'll get to watch Jamie and Claire in Outlander on Starz. I am way too excited about this.
Now to get a little off kilter.
Kilt.
Wow.
The British didn't want any kilts, tartans after Culloden Moor.
If we did the Potmatic pun cast, I'd be the only person who would do it. I'd be the only person who listened to it. And I'd be so happy, guys.
Pineapple.
So happy.
You're Kurgan me.
This is totally grape. If you follow me on Facebook, which I guess makes one person here and one listener, you may have noticed that I recently discovered a Tumblr called 70 Sci-Fi Art, a site that reposts sci-fi art from the 70s. Mainly book covers, but also Moebius, depending on Jodorowsky's pronunciation, from his art from Jodorowsky's Dune and comic book panels, and it is the best. I love it. I seem to like and or steal their art all the time. Long-time listeners know that my primary reading material from the age of 10 to about 26 was sci-fi novels from before I was born, and this site is just catnip to me. I missed the days when cover artists didn't read the book and decided to randomly paint crazy surrealist nonsense based on the title or a note from the publisher or, you know, just what they felt that day. It's amazing. Chip Kidd minimalism is fine, but not for like every book ever. Oh my God. I'm currently reading Sudden Death by Alvaro Enrique, which I can't recommend because I haven't finished it yet. A literary novel about tennis and history, and the cover is green. It has a giant feather. FFS. What do you got, Brian?
So I don't have anything today, but since you mentioned Moebius and Jodorowsky, there's a new bookstore in town, Atomic Books.
Yeah.
Right on Riverside Drive, by the Pied Piper.
Their grand opening is last weekend.
Yeah. And if you wanted to go buy all of those usually hard to find comics that Mobius and Yudorowski made, they have them there in stock, hardcover.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah. Road trip.
So Jeremy, what's tickling your fancy?
It's near my house. Tickling my fancy this week is The Power of Myth with Joseph Campbell and Bill Moyers. This is an audio recording of the 1988 documentary series featuring a conversation between myth master Joseph Campbell and curiosity sponge Bill Moyers. It's in six parts covering how myth shapes our lives, from ancient rituals to contemporary religious practice, and it's a powerful exploration of how stories shape and give meaning to our lives. It also shows how thin the barriers are between people and different faiths, and how sort of motifs recur throughout different cultures all around the world and throughout all of history, which is a fascinating, amazing thing about human brains. And it also shows you how much Joseph Campbell liked Star Wars.
Yes. Maybe the other way around.
Yeah, well, right, how much Star Wars likes Joseph Campbell.
Yes, how much George Lucas. Yeah. Yes.
George Lucas, yes, he's openly said.
The first like half of it is recorded at the library at the Skywalker Ranch, which is pretty great.
It's a story, you know, the mythic art of a young man on a quest.
It's the whole, it's lifted verbatim.
Is it the reluctant...
Refusal of the call.
Refusal of the call. Yeah.
Call to adventure, the refusal of the call, the old master, the dark father. It's great. I'm listening to the downloadable version from audio, but we've got it on CD, Playaway, DVD, and there's also a book too. And it's great. Check it out.
I have already a correction.
Awesome. All right.
Because since I forget that we play with time here on the podcast.
She walked through some stones.
Yes, I walked through some stones, the porous boundaries of time.
I jumped out of my TARDIS.
Yes. Outlander premiered on April 9th, and it will go on last week, but April 9th was the premiere of Outlander. It was a very exciting day. It was marked on my calendar, color-coded, has marked color-coded every Saturday until it ends.
Wow.
I put my shows
I wish I was that organized.
On my...
I just bought a calendar, and I'm like 36.
I put my shows on my phone, and I also put alerts. It's like, ooh, a special on Koalas is starting on PBS. I gotta turn it on.
Oh.
Corrections. Anyone have any corrections?
Fido.
Why? Jeremy, just go ahead and correct us, even though you weren't on
the show. I wasn't on the show, Michael. I just had a couple of points of privilege I wanted to say. I thought it sounded like you said our theme mucus is by Adam Dean.
He did not say that.
Also,
I can't even laugh anymore.
Also, I will not stand for being called out for mentioning Elvis Costello when Joss Whedon is a thing that exists. That's all I'm saying.
Whoa.
Let me pick up this mic and then drop it.
Let's not, or Brian will go deaf.
Okay. That's all. That's all I have. I'm leaning.
I was just going to say this 746 is arts and crafts with textiles, not paper, which is 745.54. I know my job. Sorry, guys. This is the last time, I guess, doing decimal numbers on the show. Frowny face at Emoticon.
Is that why the new Walking Dead book was cataloged in YA and not adult?
Ooh.
Oh. Mm-hmm. That's a question we'll have to take off air.
That's been corrected. It's been corrected.
I like doing decimal corners.
I do too.
Mike.
It's a learning experience. There was really good stuff at the last show, and I wanted to say all the things that I liked.
Oh, you could totally go nuts. Why not?
I really like the polite, confused laughter when Brian said, "I've read Swamp Thing," and everyone's like, moving on. That was really good.
Did you get that joke?
I got it. I can't remember the context, but I got it.
He needed you to be there for because no one else really cared.
Oh, I hit the mic.
Nah, I didn't care. I didn't care.
Alan Moore's famous run of Swamp Thing.
Oh.
He grows tubers. His human girlfriend eats one, and she has a psychedelic trip into the plant universe.
Yeah.
Oh, it's awesome. No, like you do.
Also, I like that you said world's most body-shamed librarian. That was really good. And I, too, am working on, except not very hard, getting rid of my moobs.
That's it. That's all. More information on moobs.
What is the Dewey Decimal number for that? Is there, do we need a number?
Three, four.
Would it be under medicine or
fitness?
Biology. Three,
fitness is in the 700s.
Okay.
It's 344.DD.
Sorry. That would be social sciences, the politics of moobs and
Politics of moobs. Would it be under like,
Mike, did you have corrections? I'm sorry, I have to cut in when you get the politics of moobs. Sort of a correction: the Incantations of Daniel Johnson by Ricardo
Johnston
again
by Ricardo Cavolo and Scott McClanahan will be out July 6th. But it really doesn't matter because apparently someone has a hookup. The Chariots of Fire theme music, which made appearances throughout the show, was
which by was awesome, by the way. It was totally awesome. Wow.
Was by Vangelis.
Yeah, it's the Vangelis victory lap.
Who we've talked about before on the show.
He also did the soundtrack for Blade Runner.
He did, indeed.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. I studied to that a lot in college.
Yeah. Deckard.
Who thinks the Blade Runner sequel is going to suck?
Me.
Everyone but the people investigating it. Yeah.
I think it's cool that Robin Wright is in it. I'm excited.
It's interesting that looking forward to it, actually.
It's interesting that Ridley Scott is wrong about his own movie.
Oh, I'm not surprised about that. Did you see Prometheus? For more information about ancient aliens, you can go to
my house.
The History Channel with that dude with the weird hair.
Good call.
www.library.nashville.org.
No dot.
And the music is by
Adam Dean.
You can subscribe to this, the Popmatic Podcast, on iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS feeds. Next week, Bucket List.
Bucket List.
Right. Jack Nicholson and Morgan Freeman will be showing up.
Wow.
Narrating the whole podcast.
Let's confirm that this next week is actually about the Bucket List.
You're right. Because then it's
better. It'll be Beyond the Pale.
Visit Scotland caught up with Dana Gabaldon about her inspiration and research. She gave her thoughts on the new television series and described her very first trip to Scotland, the land that inspired Outlander.
Oh, I'd never been to Scotland when I wrote Outlander. I did that from library research. I wrote the book for a practice, not intending to show it to anyone, let alone try to get it published. But, you know, things happened. Here we all are.